the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. Globalization has brought huge benefits to billions of people, but one of the drawbacks to it has been the acceleration of the disappearance of many indigenous languages around the world, as a few dominant languages, like English, replace them. There are around 6,500 languages spoken around the world today, but by one forecast, that number will fall by half by the end of this century. Here in North America, there are 278 different languages that are classified as vulnerable or endangered by the UN. In some cases, like that of the Menominee people in Wisconsin and northern Michigan, only a handful of people still speak the language fluently. But there is hope for endangered and even silent or extinct languages. Today on Global Journalist, we're going to talk to a series of people who are working on various ways to revive the endangered languages of North America. Joining us first to talk about the issue is Gregory Anderson of the Living Tongues Institute in Salem, Oregon, and Mary Lynn, a curator of cultural and linguistic revitalization at the Smithsonian Center for Folklife and Cultural Heritage in Washington, D.C. Welcome to both of you. Mary Lynn, let me start with you. Give us just a picture, if you will, of the languages of North America that are endangered. How critical is the situation?
Well, it's very critical. At the time of contact, there were over 500 languages spoken north of what is now the border between Mexico and the United States. And as you said in the beginning, over half of these are endangered, and very many of them have a few handful of older speakers. So it is critical in one hand, and getting more awareness, getting more support, especially from non-tribal people to support local languages and not be afraid of your neighbor if at home they're speaking another language than you are. But things are changing. I started doing teacher training around 1990 in Oklahoma, and at that time there were very few younger people that were learning their languages or trying to use the languages that they did know. But this has really changed now, and we see a growing number of younger people. And so things are looking up on one hand.
All right. Well, let me turn this to Gregory Anderson then. Your institution, the Living Tongues Institute, works to preserve, revitalize endangered languages around the world. Give us just a brief overview of why it's important, useful to preserve some of these languages.
Right. Well, the main reason is that these are the sort of cultural libraries, if you will, legacies of an entire lineage of history that stretches back millennia. And it's an unbroken window into the past. It helps shape people's identity, their religion, their personal narratives, their cultural narratives. So it's really the main vector of identity for indigenous people. It's different than you find in immigrant communities as well, because there's always this mythical home country that immigrant communities can say, well, if you lost your language, we can send you back to great grandmas and you can learn language. In North America, this is their homeland. There is no place for them to go back to. And the geopolitical realities is they can't restore them. So language is one of the ways they can hold on to their separate identity that they've maintained for millennia.
Well, Mary Lynn, tell us just if you would, you know, we heard in the introduction, you mentioned that the situation is quite critical for a number of languages. What are some of the factors that are driving the silencing, the extinction of some of these languages?
Well, historically, there's been many factors, including the residential schools. And of course, the public schools are equally as culpable in that in order to partake in public schooling, you really had to have access to English, and many public schools were very intolerant of Indian languages as well. Today, it's more insidious. It's things like MTV originally was a culprit. Now video, all of these new technologies and the internet, which are the access is mainly through larger languages. So there's this attractive quality to popular culture and getting access to that to the younger kids. So communities that take over internet, take over Facebook with their own languages are actually doing, I wouldn't say better, but they're attracting the younger kids in new ways, giving them new ways to use their languages in a modern setting as well, because most people are very modern as well. So that's a good thing. And of course, there's the economic attraction, you know, to get a job in the United States, you need to speak English. There's not very many places that you can go and use Caddo or Quapaw or Yuchi, as we'll hear later on, in your workplace. So definitely the economics.
Well, Gregory Anderson, let me ask you to pick up on something that Mary Lynn has raised, because we have a question via Twitter from our user Jonah McCown. He asks, how are Indigenous groups using technology to get young people to learn their language? Is it effective? Mary spoke about technology as being both sort of a threat to endangered languages, but maybe also a tool.
That's right. It is a very powerful medium. And if it's powerful in its negative aspects, that power can be flipped on itself for positive and reinforcing message sent to younger people. Younger people in particular are the bearers of the future for the language and the culture, and it's their decisions that will impact future generations. If you can find a way to pair the modern through technology and the traditional through the indigenous traditional language knowledge, that has proven to be successful. And there are lots of grassroots efforts around the country that have shown this to be a very successful medium in generating new speakers and new interests and new opportunities. These are technology and has knock-on training effects. You learn transferable skills that can get you a job. And I'd just also like to pick up a little bit on what you were saying about the economics of the language value, in, if you will, the language market. Yes, it's true that English has the highest value and is crucial to success. However, English is so strong and so dominant in the United States, it's impossible to grow up in the United States and not learn English. So it's a miscalculation of the market dynamics. You will learn English regardless. It's other languages you won't learn without the effort. So supporting those languages have lots of economic benefits, which we can go into. But really, having parents abandon languages or not allow their children to speak languages for English is insane, really, because that is going to happen regardless of what they do. Social dynamics dictate that.
That's a good point, and I want to come back to that. But first, Mary, if you could tell us just a little bit, what are, technology aside, and we're going to talk to someone who has developed sort of an interesting technological tool to preserve languages, I think. But what are, aside from technology, what are some effective strategies for reviving these languages?
Well, it has to be useful in people's everyday lives. And so it is. And kids want that use, that access to their traditional cultures and to modern culture. So when you have
but Mary, if that's the test, and if you have a language with only a few dozen speakers, how do you meet that threshold of the language being useful in their everyday lives?
Well, it gives them access to talking to elders and hopefully one of their grandparents as well. So it, and then you have to reinstate it into places like religious ceremony life, food culture, other types of ball games, anything that the kids are really interested in. So you have to work very hard at reintegrating it into those areas that the youth are interested in and that are culturally appropriate as well. So it's a hard task. It is many, many years long to revitalize languages. It's not something that you can do overnight. It's not just simply, as Greg said, to go to a class, you know, and learn it and then have access to being able to speak it fluently with somebody who can speak it fluently back to you. That doesn't happen. It's a long, long road. But reintroducing what we call taking back areas of your life and reestablishing them in the language.
Okay. Well, Greg, let me move that to you then. Are there some specific success stories that we can talk about in North America or around the world where languages that were silenced, where there were no more fluent speakers, have been revived? What are some examples of those?
Sure. Well, the most obvious success story is probably Hawaiian in terms of the number of speakers that it's generated. The Cherokee language immersion program there in Oklahoma actually has been fairly successful. Here in Oregon, we have the Grand Ronde, Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde, who have successfully implemented Chinook Wawa in an immersion program from very young age, age of three, and new speakers of Chinook Wawa have been generated. And on a smaller scale, also here in Oregon, the Confederated Tribes of Siletz Indians have implemented their Siletz Deni, an Athabascan language that they have promoted as the one of the 27 languages of the Confederated Tribes of Siletz Indians to promote in the school. And in the last 15 years I've been working with them, I've seen a fair number of younger children using the language in the schooling context, which simply didn't exist in the early 2000s. So, and technology also, a lot of interesting new computer-based instructional methodologies and things have been implemented in the Siletz school, and they all seem to be generating interest among the user groups.
And Mary Lynn, if I could turn this to you then, because we did hear Gregory talking about some of the success stories here, and I was wondering if there's a model for how to make these programs successful, because I think many people can accept that there is real cultural value in the preservation of these languages that are endangered. But sort of as a practical matter, I imagine that in some cases it's difficult to convince parents that they're, you know, they should be spending the time to put their children in intensive language lessons when the language is only spoken by a very limited number of people, a few dozen, a few hundred people. The parents might say, well, why shouldn't my student be doing computer science or Spanish or any other number of different activities?
Well, that is one argument that you could speak to more people, but I think for most tribal people, that the argument for your own language is a lot stronger because it does give you access to cultural heritage. So the real question is, in putting a child in an immersion preschool, or then you're taking them out of a known academically accredited schooling program, and that is sometimes hard for parents to do. So the benefits really outweigh any kind of perceived lack of curriculum in immersion schools. It's becoming more documented, but it's still well documented with Hawaiian, Hualapai, and some other international bilingual schools that kids do much better in an immersion school where they are comfortable in the language, it's culturally appropriate. Their test scores go back, they stay in school longer, their test scores go up, they enter colleges better, they are better citizens in their own and in larger community endeavors later on in life. We also have the arguments for bilingual education in general that cognitive abilities go up in children, creativity abilities go up in children. So there really are good arguments to put your child in a bilingual school and put them in the local bilingual school as well. But there's just overall misconception of what bilingualism means. And there is that kind of fear that Greg got to a little bit earlier that we're talking about monolingualism and we're not. Nobody's wanting to go back to another language. Everybody's wanting to add on to English.
It's really a supplement there. And Mary, I'm sorry we're out of time, so I'm going to have to stop you there. But Gregory Anderson, Mary Lynn, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you.
A reminder that you're listening to Global Journalist. We're talking today about endangered languages in North America, where as many as 278 native tongues face the threat of linguistic extinction. If you're interested in more Global Journalist content, visit us online at globaljournalist.org. There you can find more coverage of undercovered international news and human rights issues. You can also like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or subscribe to the videocast of this program on YouTube. We're going to talk now about how one group that has just three remaining fluent speakers of its native languages is trying to revive. Hundreds of years ago, the Yuchi people were a large tribe living in the southeastern U.S., but war and diseases brought by Europeans decimated the tribe in the 1700s, and they were forcibly moved to what is now Oklahoma in the 1800s. Richard Grounds is the director of the Yuchi Language Project and is an adjunct professor at Phillips Seminary in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Richard, welcome.
I gotta say, let's introduce you, Stanley. Kalanja, Dr. Shah.
And Richard, thanks very much. So you were responding to us in Yuchi. Can you tell us what you just said?
Well, I was just greeting you in our beautiful Yuchi language and saying I appreciated the conversation to this point and the importance of the discussion.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. I was hoping that you could tell us a little bit about your family's personal experience. We heard Mary Lynn talking some about the history of the U.S. government's efforts to essentially wipe out native languages earlier in the 20th century, at the end of the 19th century, through the use of boarding schools where children were forced to speak English and were told not to speak in their indigenous languages. I understand your grandmother, some family members attended schools like this.
Yes, we have here in where Yuchis have been forcibly removed to 170 years ago, what became the state of Oklahoma, in the town of Sepulpa. My grandmother grew up, like many other Yuchi children at that time, not knowing English. So she was sent to boarding school. Here in Sepulpa, they had the Yuchi Mission boarding school. And that the purpose of that mission was, of course, to stop the languages, to stop the singing in the languages, to stop the dancing, to, in effect, block the flow of tradition, the heritage of tribal people, Yuchi people, from one generation to the next.
And what was the effect of that? What was the effect of that on your grandmother?
Well, it was very effective. And although my grandmother was one of the few children who went as a young teen, in other words, she was twice as old as the age that they liked to drag the kids into the boarding school system, which meant that they didn't actually wash the language out of her mouth, but there was a brainwashing effect so that they didn't get her, as they did many of the young children, they did not get her to forget her language, but they did convince her that she shouldn't speak the language to her children. So my father actually did not grow up speaking the language because she would not engage him or his sister.
So your grandmother knew the language, retained the language, but wouldn't speak it to her own children as a result of this.
Yeah. So in other words, it was like kind of a brainwashing, an internalized colonialism in which our own people become the enforcers of the colonial regime intended to block the transmission of our language to future generations.
Well, talk to me, if you would, about the Yuchi language program in Oklahoma. What was the impetus for you to try to revive the language?
Well, I can say that our languages are probably the most critical piece of the cultural health of our traditional communities. So the language is absolutely essential to our ceremonial ways, and it's important in our churches. We are trying to continue those traditions. This is the most urgent crisis in Indian country today because of the impact of language loss. So it's all about keeping our languages alive for future generations.
And as I mentioned, there are just three fluent speakers of the language. I believe all of them are in their 80s now. Is the goal to rebuild the number of fluent speakers in Yuchi, or are you just trying to get more people to have some knowledge of the language?
Our focus is very specific. Our intention is to grow new fluent speakers. That is to say, the richness of our heritage, the fullness of our knowledge is carried in the language. So we really don't put a lot of value in bits of language knowledge scattered in a lot of places or carried with a lot of young people. We're really focused on growing new fluent speakers who are able to carry forward the fullness of our language. One of the amazing things that we've been able to do at this very place where my grandmother and her cousins and, you know, where they were all punished for speaking their language, the Yuchi language, the Muscogee Creek language, these young children were very cruelly punished for literally for asking for a piece of bread in their language. And now we have been able to turn that around. And at that same location where the Yuchi mission stood is now the Sapulpa Public Education System. And there's a auditorium there, and we have the Yuchi Knowledge Bowl every year in that location as a way of showcasing the learning of our young people, our youth, as they begin to pick up the language, and they're able to use the language in that very place where the languages were brutally suppressed over many generations.
Well, our time does grow short, Richard, but just briefly, could you talk to me about what are some of the challenges in trying to expand Yuchi now? Do you find that parents are interested in having their children learn it? Are children themselves interested in learning it?
In a real sense, there is a interest in the language in the community. At the same time, we are living in the larger waters of American society, in which there's a big push for English only, in which there's a great deal of pushback against any other language that's not English. So we do take it upon ourselves as a program to help generate the interest in the language, to help push back the kind of internal colonized thinking that our people have been saddled with for some generations now. So we directly try to address that. We want to elevate the prestige of the languages. We want to get, you know, our kids' pictures in the paper for, you know, the kind of learning that they're doing, for their abilities and skills that they're developing in the language.
Well, Richard Grounds, thank you so much for joining us.
Sanakiyasuta.
Thanks again. As I mentioned earlier, the internet has been a force for spreading English around the world, but it's also become a tool for preserving indigenous languages. Up next, we're going to talk to Kevin Scannell. He's a professor of computer science at St. Louis University. He's also the creator of IndigenousTweets.com, a website that tries to help people around the world tweeting in indigenous languages find each other on Twitter. Kevin, welcome to Global Journalist.
Morning. Thank you.
Well, tell us, if you would, how did you get interested in trying to sort of catalog people tweeting in indigenous languages?
Sure. Well, I came to the work originally as a speaker of an endangered language, a European endangered language, Irish Gaelic, which is my heritage language. I learned as an adult, and as somebody in the diaspora separated from the homeland of the language and trying to use it on a daily basis, the internet and social media was a big part of that for me. And I was frustrated when I started out trying to use Twitter in the language to even just find other people tweeting in Irish Gaelic.
And I'm sorry, tell us just a little bit then about this tool that you created as a result of that.
Sure. So in that process, what I did, I'm a computer scientist by training. So I wrote a computer program that started to collect all of the people tweeting in my own language to start, and created the website as sort of a catalog of those people, along with some statistics about how often they tweeted in the language, who had the most followers and so on, as a sort of menu for who to follow in your language. And then building on that, I started to do it for some other languages as well. And now the site catalogs about 180 indigenous languages and minority languages.
And so when you go on the website, if you're looking to find someone tweeting on the language in your own indigenous language, then what do you need to do? What does it help you do?
Sure. So on the main page, you can find the name of your language, and you click on that, and then it takes you to a language page, which is simply a list of everybody with their profile picture and some statistics about how often they tweet and so on. If you're like me, I'm mostly interested in following people who tweet primarily in the language. So you can look at who tweets, say, 95% of the time in the language versus somebody who might tweet bilingually, and then based on that, decide who you want to follow.
Tell us, what are some of the challenges to tweeting in an indigenous language? Is it, I imagine that, you know, much of the internet is built around English or a few larger languages. What are some of the specific difficulties to this?
Well, there are a few, and it really varies from language to language. For my own language, things are pretty easy to do, but for many others, there are obstacles to even being able to type your language on a keyboard. Maybe you have a keyboard on the computer, but you can't type your language on a mobile device, for example. And then many times when you, even if you are able to input your language correctly, it may not display the way it's supposed to because of fonts that are missing and so on.
And this is because some languages use entirely different alphabets or alphabets that have some different characters or letters than the Latin alphabet or other common alphabets.
Precisely, precisely.
And so what sorts of feedback have you had from users about this?
I've had good feedback in terms of the ability for people to use the site and use it as a way to build community on social media in the language. One of the sort of unexpected things was that there was sort of a competitive aspect to the website. So it displays people in terms of it ranks them essentially in terms of who has the most tweets in a given language. And it was sort of an unexpected aspect that people would be competitive and try and be the number one tweeter in language X or language Y.
Okay. And so in general, then, based on your experience, how useful do you think technology, in particular Twitter, social media, is in endangering saving languages?
It's one piece. I'm a computer scientist, and this is the part of language revitalization that I have the skills to actually work on. But it's really only one piece of a much bigger puzzle. Greg spoke earlier about the importance of trying to reach young people, especially. And if young people are on social media, it's incredibly important to make that environment friendly for them to use their language. But again, it's just one piece in a much bigger puzzle.
And if I could get you to look in your crystal ball for a moment and talk to us about the future, how do you see that the evolution of indigenous languages and technology will change over the next 5 years, 10 years?
Well, there are a couple big obstacles. One is that most of social media is written language. So Facebook and Twitter are primarily written media. And in fact, the majority of those 6,500 languages you mentioned in the world are not written languages at all. They're never really written by their communities. And so because of that, I'm hoping to see sort of a transition to other forms of social media, which are more friendly to spoken language. The other kind of direction is for smaller languages to work in collaboration with some of the big tech companies and social media companies to make those platforms available in the indigenous language and to create sort of an immersive environment so that you can use Facebook or Twitter entirely in your language.
So it sounds like generally then you're optimistic that technology will be an aid to endangered languages and not sort of a hindrance then.
I do believe that. It overcomes a lot of obstacles, especially the geographic obstacles that many communities face where they're scattered away from their sort of home community.
Well, great. Well, Kevin Scannell, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's going to have to do it for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA. Our assistant producers this week are Wei-Ming Bao, Fallon Page, Sophia Satter, and Hannah Sandfeld. Our supervising producer is Jinhong Chen, and our visuals editor is Alyssa Blyle. Pat Akers is our audio engineer, and Travis McMillan is our studio director. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.